Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Gommans, and I'm here with film critic Hugo Emmertzahl.
Hey, what's up?
We're going to chat about how one man from the 1600s continues to influence cinema today, and that guy is William Shakespeare.
Never heard of him.
He's one of the main characters in Chloe Zhao's new film, Hamnet, which we're going to talk about. And we're also going to discuss some other new releases like Linklater's Blue Moon and The Tale of Cillian, a touching documentary about a man and a stork. If you want to support the work we do, then you can leave us a review and share with friends as it helps more cinema lovers find us. Before we begin, I'd love to share some cool things that are going on in the coming weeks here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. A quick reminder that on the 28th of January, we have a Fight the Power screening of Goodbye Julia, followed by a panel talk discussing the ongoing genocide in Sudan. Also check out our current program, Diaspora Diaries, which explores emotional, physical, and mental journeys of people navigating life away from their original homeland. That includes films like the classic Black Girl by Ousmane Sembene, Past Lives by Celine Song, and of course, Bend It Like Beckham. On the 30th of January, there will be a special screening of Chantal Akerman's News from Home, including an introduction. Hugo, man, what a
Lara.
Week. We just came off the Golden Globes a couple days ago when we're recording this. Fun fact, you are part of the voting body this year for the Golden Globes. How was that experience for you?
The voting in itself and everything around it it's quite fascinating because... I mean, I'm a film critic, right? And I go to a lot of festivals and usually I deal with more, let's say, quote unquote, serious art cinema. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you find yourself in this environment of the industry, which is very, you know, award focused. The Golden Globes are the most important awards in the journey leading up to the Oscars, of course.
Yep.
So you get a million emails from PR people about press conferences with this actor, and do you want a one-on-one 4-minute online interview with Sydney Sweeney, or do you want to do this? All of these kind of like insane PR kind of bits.
Did you go have lunch with Sydney Sweeney?
No, actually, I was close to doing the 4-minute interview, but then I also thought, what am I going to do with the 4-minute interview?
I mean, as someone who also often interviews people, you usually get like 6 minutes, and it's like, well.
Well, how are you doing? Great. Yes, thank you. That's all for
today.
Yeah,
so all you can really get in like a 4 to 6 minute is like a clippy soundbite, which is annoying for them and it's annoying for us.
For everybody. Like,
yeah.
Well, and that's maybe a good summation of some aspects of the Golden Globes, that it's like, it feels very often like much ado about nothing, but then simultaneously it is an interesting way to get access to some filmmakers to do bigger interviews. Like, for instance, we'll be talking about Chloe Zhao's Hamnet, which won at the Golden Globes quite well as well. And it allowed me to do like a 30-minute interview with her and the screenwriter and the novelist of the original source material of Hamnet, Connie O'Farrell. So yeah, so these things are very interesting and great, and I kind of like this entire circus around it. So I also woke up at the middle of the night around 2 or 3 in the morning to watch the ceremony itself, which is, as any other award ceremony, somewhat between endearing and fun and insane cringe at the same time.
Right.
So I have to say it was a journey, it's an experience, and I'm very hyped to be hopefully back in the Golden Globes fold next
year. How do you even get selected for something like that?
You can apply as a foreign journalist because they had too many American journalists, and the Golden Globes voting body is like consisting of journalists, right, worldwide. And there were too many Americans, so they have a new diversity inclusivity scheme for a couple of years already
before it gets canceled.
Exactly. No, and the Golden Globes itself is also already like a very, let's say, controversial awards body because there's talks of corruption and bribery
and thing.
I applied, you sent in a lot of your articles, motivation, CV, this and that, and then you go through a very deep screening process. Actually, I had to give like a document from our government that I am not in like odds with the law, that I am an upstanding citizen. And
prove it. Okay, so now we know that you're an upstanding citizen. So that's good to find out about Hugo.
Actually, well, let's see. That's in the eye of the beholder. But yeah, so it's a big process. And then when you're in, you're kind of in, I guess. So it was something. Did you enjoy watching and taking in this entire award thing?
I enjoy awards. I enjoy the kind of like ceremony of it. I think Nikki Glaser's great.
Yeah, she did great.
I think she's a really good host. I really like what she said beforehand, that she was like, I'm not here to ruin anyone's night. Like, I'm here to, like, take digs at people but laugh with them and not at them. And I think we've had years where it was, for example, Ricky Gervais, who's just, like, a miserable git and just wants to, like, ruin everyone's night. And I'm like, yeah, of course there needs to be room for, like, real talk. Like, hey, we're all sitting here. Like, Mark Ruffalo, for example, on the red carpet, did a lot of talking about, like, the current political situation. And he's like, yeah, we're all sitting here kind of, like, Hunger Games style in the Capitol, like, cheersing to our accomplishments, but the world is on fire. But I think Nikki Glaser in this capacity is good. She's light. I think she's sharp and funny. And yeah. And I think the outcome of most of the awards were things I would agree with. So,
I mean, I voted for all of the things almost. I did my best and I'm happy to see most of the results.
Are there any like big snubs in your eyes?
Not necessarily. I think a lot of people were kind of surprised in the foreign film category to see that Jafar Panahi did not win with it was just an accident, but that it was Kleber Mendoza Filho who won for The Secret Agent, because these are the two films that seem to be contending in this category also for the Oscars. And due to the fact that Panahi, of course, fled Iran, again has a prison sentence on the top of his head, like dangling like the sword of Damocles, there seems to be a lot of goodwill for him. And he seems to be right now, of course, also with the U.S.-Iranian relations, which at the moment of recording are absolutely insane. You know, a lot of people predicted that he would come out of the Golden Globes as the winner and would also take home the Oscars, which we're about to find out quite soon. So that was somewhat of a surprise. I'm not saying that I'm more for or against either of the films, but that was, I would say, the biggest surprise of the evening.
Yeah, we just previously, before we started recording, discussed that kind of like joke, quote unquote, that Judd Apatow did when he was handing out the Best Director award, and he opens the envelope and he goes, "Oh, I don't really know how to pronounce this, Paul Thomas Anderson. And that like filled me with rage, because there's three people in that category with non-American names. It's Chloe Zhao, it's Joachim Trier, and it's Jafar Panahi, and you could see all of them go, "What?" And then it's like, I thought that was just kind of cruel and shitty. And Judd Apatow has been irrelevant for like 20 years.
Very irrelevant.
But why are you even handing out awards?
This says a lot about award ceremonies as well. Like, even when they're somewhat good, they can still always have a portion of cringe. And that's just kind of an inevitability, I think, of this entire trade-off between, you know, bestowing these films with prestige, but also everything seems a bit clownesque in between, right? You can kind of see the seams of these operations very clearly during these ceremonies.
It's a
journey, and I'm very hyped to see what's going to happen at the Oscars. But I'm also, to be honest, very happy when all this shit is over and we can just finally relax and watch films in a normal capacity.
True. Let's talk about Hamnet, because we just talked about the Golden Globes. Jessie Buckley is really a highlight for me, and she received the Best Actress award at the Golden Globes. So Hamnet is a movie by Chloe Zhao. It's about William Shakespeare and his wife Agnes, which is actually Anne Hathaway, but not the actress, but the actual lady. And it's their love story, how they meet. She's kind of like a foresty lady. She's like witchy. And they fall in love. They have children. Well, abridged version. Plague happens. Kid dies.
No, not the plague.
Plague happens. Kid dies. And then it's about like this intense grief and how these two people in this marriage deal with their grief in very different ways. I'd say I thought it was so beautiful.
I thought it was gorgeous as
well. Oh my God. Here's a clip.
I'll miss you. But I have to go, you understand? I
know. I understand.
That's good. Because I need you to look after your mother and your sisters. Will you do that?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Yes. Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Yes! Ah! Yes, I'll be brave. I'll be brave.
I think from like 30 minutes into the movie till the Max Richter score at the end stopped, I was in tears.
Me too. No, I was shocked. You know, I came into this film admittedly with quite low expectations. I was at the British premiere of the film during the BFI Film Festival in London, which was insane because, like, at the opening proceedings, suddenly you have Steven Spielberg on stage speaking because he's a producer on the film. And I thought, yeah, okay, Chloe Zhao, you know, Nomadland, she won an Oscar. It was a huge success. But in retrospect, the film was insufferable. Let's be brutally honest, right? This film was too much.
It didn't stick.
And as a matter of fact, it soured like milk. It just doesn't feel like the right film. Her previous films, Sons My Brother Taught Me, and The Rider were good, but very loose, right? She made them and wrote the scenario because she spent a lot of time in this Pine Ridge reservation, spending time with Native Americans living on the land, and then these stories arose. So I thought, okay, she has a very unique process of working, but then you have Nomadland, it became a bit insufferable. You have the Eternals, her flopped Marvel movie, Never Forget. So I thought, maybe Zhao is on the way out. Maybe this is not a good director anymore. Mm-hmm. But she works with this script, an adaptation of the book of the same name, and suddenly you see all the qualities that she has as a director come to the front in a story that's very compact because it's, what, a grieving couple and a family in struggle. And it works so well. I was crying the entire time. It's just gorgeous. Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is on Jesse Buckley, obviously, who has this really powerful, almost like Earth Mother performance. Yeah. Like, she connects to the woods. She wants to give birth by the tree.
Yeah, and in the opening shot of the film, you see her like in the wood, and it's like the wood is her womb, and the camera circles around her and goes up with a crane. And then you have this gorgeous Max Richter score. Like, everything is just already pushing you towards her. Like, you feel her very strongly from the beginning.
Absolutely. And just like her raw emotion and the grief. But I also have to say, and this has to be a testament to Chloe Zhao, every single child performer was incredible. And that can't just be like a lucky hit that they got, like, because if you have like one really good child in your movie, it's probably that child is really good. If you have like five children and they're all insanely good, that's on her.
And usually with child performers, like, it's I don't know how it works. Maybe it's because I'm, you know, a man, but it's like usually I'm always very annoyed by young boys in films because they're kind of like, they have this icky American young boy demeanor, and it just feels fake and like it feels like trickery, right? So I'm usually very skeptic when there's films with young boys. I always see them as fake, weird creatures.
You're thinking too much of what's happening behind the scenes.
Just
of like
the way they present boyishness as well. It just feels very cloying. And then I saw this kid, and I'm sitting next to my girlfriend, and I'm whispering in her ear, I love this boy. He's so sweet.
He's so sweet.
And then things happen in the film, and you're crying the entire time. Oh. It's like, I was whispering this in her ear, like, I love this kid. He's so cute. And then 15 minutes later, I'm just crying. So this is great. Oh. And I knew that the film was good. Like, I could trust that I could kind of let go of all my initial skepticism when there's this shot where Paul Mescal is walking over the somewhat village square, and there's a dog in the middle of the square, and he's just passing, and it's this ultra wide shot of him going through the street, and he just casually pets the dog and then walks further. And then I'm like, okay, this is great because I believe everything. Yeah. This is a lived in real place with real people, real characters, big emotions, and all of these big emotions then are deserved, right?
What I did think was funny, which is actually correct, but like, they let Paul Mescal keep his slutty little like East London mullet
of course.
Earring, and it's like, yeah, of course, like, William Shakespeare also has an earring, that's well documented, but he had the cool like the bald the bald head with the little like wreath of hair around it, and I'm kind of upset that they didn't do the bald.
Yeah, but it's also good because it is like a good film, I think, and a good biopic does not try to go for the easy facsimile of like a clean copy of the person that you're supposedly playing.
Absolutely. And I think it's also good for the girls and the gays that Paul Mescal was kept hot.
Of course. And in general, the film is interesting, right? Because the film kind of sells itself on two distinct kind of features. One of them, of course, is this is a film about William Shakespeare and about the emotional process and grief that led up to him writing his most famous play, The Play. Hamlet.
Yeah, the tragedy, because before that it was mostly comedies, or only comedies, I believe, and then...
Exactly, and then at the other hand, it is mostly a film about Agnes and about Jesse Buckley's character and about how she tries to put this family together and also suffer the male genius of the guy who's constantly going away to London to perform his plays and to write and to work with his actors, basically abandoning his family in moments of dire emotional need.
Yeah.
So the film constantly kind of like tiptoes between those two things, and this oscillation I thought was very interesting as well, because it feels like you're in the presence of the aura of Shakespeare without mystifying him or idolizing him to such a degree that he overshadows what is a very basic story, right? It's just a man and a woman wanting a family, and then things happen.
Yeah.
I thought this was great. I was very impressed by the weight of everything and the historical significance, but that the emotional core is actually always stronger than anything else.
Yeah. What's funny to me is that obviously we both went in knowing that it's about William Shakespeare. And I don't know if this means that media literacy is dead, but I saw several people on TikTok going almost like it was like a Marvel reveal when they're like in the third, sometime in the third act, they're like visiting him in London and they just go like, we're looking for William Shakespeare. And people on TikTok have said that was like a huge surprise for them. It's like, what? It's about Shakespeare? It's like, yeah, man. Like, yeah, like he's writing Romeo and Juliet. Like,
and also, like, there's something very funny about the film is called Hamnet, just like the book, right? Hamnet is the son of Shakespeare who died, and he based the play or the name of the play Hamlet on the name of his past son, right? And then in the opening titles of the film, it is also explained Hamlet was historically known
as. Which I thought was such a weird
Hamlet,
like opening.
Yes, and they're like over explaining it at the beginning, and I was like, okay, they think I'm an idiot, right?
Yeah. But turns out people are idiots.
Yes, people need it. And again, I think this opening titles and the fact that influencers on TikTok don't understand that this film is about Shakespeare only illustrates how easily this film could have gone wrong, right?
Yeah.
Because it could have been a somewhat more sentimental, like Shakespeare in love kind of romanticized version of the past. It could have also been like let's completely demystify Shakespeare and make him like boring and banal, but it kind of does something in between all the time, and yeah, it's super impressive.
Yeah.
And that also has to do, I think, with the audio-visual language of Zhao, who has, in the past, especially with Nomadland, gone too far, I think, sometimes with this kind of Terrence Malick transcendental, like, sweeping camera movements and this more elliptical montage and, you know, the shots just roaming through the landscape and these more impressionist moments. And here it works super, super well. It's a texturally dense film, and the score is absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm.
Just one Golden Globes thing, for instance, is that also through that, I had the pleasure of having a very big interview with Max Richter about the score. We spoke for like 45 minutes, and he's telling that he's going back to Elizabethan music principles of this era, sourcing many of these instruments that were being used, but in a score that's definitely not traditional, because there's a lot of synthesizers, there's a lot of like modern, minimal, classical ambient music.
Female voice.
The female voices were gorgeous in it as well, but also these deep, rumbling, subsonic basses that go through the cinema. It's like you're watching the Christopher Nolan movie, like, just like the floor is almost shaking. It's super cool, you know? There's a lot of interesting choices being
made. And what's
fun
about that, the piece that they use in kind of the big scene, that's an existing piece that's already been used in like Arrival, Shutter Island. And he wrote a piece, well, you will know this because you interviewed him, but he wrote a piece for the ending.
Yeah.
And then Chloe Zhao was like, yeah, but kind of like, I'm kind of attached to the idea of
this
using this existing one, which is quite unusual. And I really think this movie does a good job at not making you think about the other other pieces of art that you know this music from. It really makes it its own, and I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Richter like wrote most of the score before they even started shooting. He got the script and the idea of Zhao, and he immediately wrote like 45 minutes of music, sent it to her, and then they used it in the production team all the time for every aspect of the film. So even when Chloe was driving around location scouting, she's playing the music and seeing if the landscape overlaps with the music. On set, they were playing the music already so that they could get into the emotional intensity of the scene. So this like synthesis between all of these different elements in the film, it's very accomplished. I'm like, I was very impressed.
Mm-hmm.
I came out of the cinema with this feeling that you don't have that often anymore, that you just feel shocked, you know, that you're like, I felt clean. I felt like I cried so much, and it was such a personally important film because it makes you think about things like family and, you know, life and death and love and all of these things. And it felt like a film that pointed me towards a future or something. It was great. It was a useful film for me.
Just very quickly, who is Max Richter?
Max Richter is like a German-born but UK-based composer who kind of shook up the classical world with his distinct version of minimal music, which, you know, we know ambient music from Brian Eno, and he took some of these principles to more hardcore classical music, for instance. He completely rearranged Vivaldi's Four Seasons to make it a more minimal classical piece, which is a quite controversial thing to do in the more conservative classical world. But this, it was a huge success. He composed for quite a couple of great films and filmmakers, including like Waltz with Bashir by Ari Folman. And he has a lot of acclaimed albums, some of them going insanely long. Like he has an album called Sleep, which you should listen to while you sleep as well, because it
feels like breathing. Like,
yeah, and that's like a 10-hour album. So yeah, he's kind of like the rock star of contemporary classic music, I would say. And he's a very gifted film composer.
So that movie is about William Shakespeare. There are several movies that are about William Shakespeare. You already mentioned Shakespeare in Love, for example. There's tons of movies that are about Shakespeare plays. There's also movies like The Tragedy of Macbeth, the things Romeo and Juliet, obviously so many movies that are very evidently based on Shakespeare plays. But I just quickly wanted to touch on some other movies that we love that are based on Shakespeare plays but are maybe less obvious.
Secret Shakespeare.
Pow, 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 pow. That's a beautiful category. So I think one of the most famous examples of this is The Lion King.
Mm-hmm.
The Lion King is about a prince and an uncle killing the king and a spirit speaking to him to take his place on the throne. And, you know, that's like, it's not hiding it very well that it's Hamlet, but it's something that you don't think about. It's like, oh, when I was 6 years old, I was into Shakespeare, apparently.
Right? Yes. And then you have, I guess, films like Akira Kurosawa's Throne of Blood, which is a take on Macbeth.
Ron, which is King Lear.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, there are so many. And it's interesting to think about these things because, like, we very often talk about films in terms of novelty, right? And about, like, what is the plot bringing us now? And then it's maybe also very refreshing sometimes to realize that a lot of the stories that we're being told are reiterations of already stories of the past.
There's even a book by George Pulte, which is called The 36 Dramatic Situations,
exactly,
which says that basically in humanity, we only tell 36 different stories. So basically anything you watch or tell or see or read, you can kind of slot into one of these 36 things. Some other fun ones that I have here are Mean Girls, which is just Julius Caesar.
Oh, insane.
Like the A2 Brute kind of thing.
Wow.
And
I never realized
it's really
that.
Fun to watch it through that lens and see the similarities between those two. Another personal favorite of mine, She's the Man. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yes,
it's
of course.
It's Amanda Bynes.
Yes.
And it's The Twelfth Night.
Oh, insane.
It's the gender swap thing of like she wants to take her place, but she has to like dress up as a man and not be found out. But then, oh no, she falls in love and it's really complicated. Because I feel like when it came out, I was already a little too old to like it because it came out when I was 17. However, that did not stop me from liking them.
No, of course not. It's a video rental classic, right?
It was
like,
beautiful.
Yeah.
10 Things I Hate About You, The Taming of the Shrew. And it's like a slightly more feminist retelling of like...
My mind is blown. This is
yeah,
dope.
There's so yeah. many. There's so many. It's really fun to kind of dive into this. Obviously, there's more obvious ones like West Side Story, which is so clearly Romeo and Juliet. but also movies like Warm Bodies, which is between kind of the love between a zombie and a lady. And I think there's the Romeo and Juliet trope kind of is recognizable in so many movies. Don't want us to be together. But what I think is interesting in Hamnet is that Shakespeare tells Agnes a Greek tragedy. He tells her the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. Yeah. And it's like, of course, Shakespeare's not the person that came up with all these things. He's just the person that happened to write all of them down, and they all stood the test of time.
I want to give one critical aside on this film, which I thought was the most ridiculous scene.
I know what you're going to say. I think we're going to agree on this.
And also, it makes me even more surprised about the TikTokers, you know, being shocked about this being Shakespeare, because there's literally, and this is not a big spoiler, it's a very insignificant scene, sure. I would say. After, you know, the son passes away and William and Agnes are grieving in their own way, Shakespeare's in London and it's a derelict, nasty place with the plague, as you already mentioned. And he's somewhere at the docks by himself and he's peering over
edge.
Yes, he's like, drunk and he's peering over the edge, looking into the water. And he's maybe considering jumping in and killing himself as well. And then he just starts to be. Or not to be. That is the question. And then you're
he says the whole thing.
Yeah, and he just does the whole soliloquy, and you're like, no, what the fuck is going on?
It was really cringe. I did the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing at the TV meme. It's like, he's saying the thing.
I'm crying the entire film, and then I'm suddenly rolling my eyes next to my girlfriend, like, what the fuck is this? You know, it's like a way to kind of make it so insanely blunt, but yeah, maybe it was needed. I don't know.
It reminded me of those scenes in those musical biopics where they write the big song.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. I thought that moment was cringe. And I think if there's ever a director's cut, please, Chloe, just cut that scene out because it sucks.
It sucks badly.
So the next movie I want to talk about is Blue Moon. Blue Moon is a biographical comedy drama by Richard Linklater that unfolds over a single night in 1943. It's centered around legendary Broadway lyricist Lawrence Hart, played magnificently by Ethan Hawke. And he's the writer of tons of songs, including Blue Moon. You know the one. He's at the opening party for Oklahoma, the famous musical that we still all know. And that's by his ex-writing partner, Richard Rodgers. And Hart, you know, is really jealous of his part. And he just kind of grapples with that and his fading relevance and personal demons and his desire for a 20-year-old in this movie. Here's a clip.
The second we have to celebrate, this is the greatest musical in the history of American theater.
No, I'm not drinking with you, Larry.
Okay. Ouija, shoot this, huh?
What?
Oh, no. No.
Larry, I got it.
Rodgers and Hart, together again.
All right, closer.
Come on, closer.
What did you think of Blue Moon?
I was quite surprised, actually, because this was a year in which Linklater did two very
movies.
Distinct things. He made also the film Nouvelle Vague about La Nouvelle Vague,
which we talk about on a previous episode if you want to go back to that.
Exactly. So you have one film about Lawrence Hart and the Great American Songbook and these somewhat forgotten, you know, legends of America's storied cultural past. And then you have the, let's say, most revered artistes from the French cinema, two biopic films that work, I think, completely differently, but both share these classic Linklater traits. Of this kind of naturalist, laissez-faire, minimal plotting, a lot of dialogue to get very close to these characters. And I enjoyed both of these films very much. Mm-hmm. And Blue Moon felt just like a very nice time at the movies to spend time with these actors and the characters that they inhabit. And this kind of weird environment in which all this cultural elite, but actually it's not that elitist, right, because it's just basically musicals that they're making, are enjoying these parties and drinking and gossiping. It was funny and cute, and it was I am not into this cultural phenomenon at all, and I was vibing with it, you know. I enjoyed it. How about you?
I also really liked it. I thought Nouvelle Vague was good, but I didn't really... Well, Alita and I talked about it at length, but I didn't really see the purpose of why this movie was made. It would have maybe been better as a TV show or whatever. I liked it in the way that I like listening to podcasts about how movies are made.
Yeah, I'm sure.
With this one, I was actually quite pleasantly surprised at how much I enjoyed it. And I really feel like anyone should greenlight any movie that Richard Linklater wants to make that's literally just Ethan Hawke yapping.
You can just put him in the room. And
it's great.
And he's such a, you know, captivating actor, and this character that he plays, this Lawrence Hart, he's such a messy bitch, right? He's like a queen.
He's omnisexual. Yes.
And he's so hungry for everything, you know, for admiration, for love, for desire, for sex. And you can see this kind of like constant hunger and yearning. But he does it with such sly coolness and giddiness and playfulness. He's like very queer and gay in the old sense of the word, that he has this gaiety, you know, this just kind of like elevated kind of gestural behavior, this kind of like feigned happiness. It was fun to watch because Ethan Hawke is just such a magnetic screen presence always.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me a bit more about Lawrence Hart? Because when you're reading his songs and plays, I had no idea.
Oh, really?
He's like one of the most esteemed, you know, composers and writers of these great musicals of the Great American Songbook is what they called, which are
some classic,
basically like proto pop music before it became the thing of the radio and the television after the 1950s and 60s. This is very much a pre-World War II, not American dominating the entire world with its pop culture, but just American culture of the early 20th century. And he was one of the greatest to do it. And these songs are always very, let's say, like inspired by big band jazzy kind of things. Right.
So My Funny Valentine is another really famous one that you might know. And they do a good job of assuming that you don't know who he is in the movie. So he does, like, there's this pianist and he keeps like talking to someone, oh no, there's a delivery guy. Yeah. And he's like, oh, you know me, this song. And he kind of like sings some of the songs. And then you as a viewer also go, oh yeah. Like you'll know the songs when you
and that's exactly also the point, because what the main anxiety of this character, this Lawrence Hart, is at this moment is that his main writing partner, this guy who wrote Oklahoma, is now debuted in his own play, and that he feels like he's fading into obscurity. It's like the passing of the time, and he feels it weighed down on him. And then that affects every other aspect of his life, right? Like, how am I being perceived by others? Am I still lovable? Am I fuckable? Am I, you know, bankable? Can somebody hire me to do whatever I want to do?
Do people want to come to my party? Does this,
So there's all of this anxiety and this fear of missing out. And this is a classic Linklaterian thing, right? That you can kind of feel the time slipping through his hand as if it's sand that he's trying to hold on to. But you know the inevitability of the passing of time. And that's what most, if not all films of Linklater are about. So it's interesting that they take a guy who used to be a legend of American culture, and we don't talk about him now. So he's also kind of reviving this mindset of the past. So it's a very good question. Who's this guy anyway? That's when I came into the film, I was also like,
didn't know. Yeah. So he has basically this obsession with this 20-year-old student who wants to be an actress, played by Margaret Qualley. Might not be as good as we think she is.
Margaret Qualley was never a good actress, to be brutally
she's
honest.
She's really pretty.
She's gorgeous and she's hot, and she was fantastic in The Substance, because maybe she's also not a good actress because The Substance is about style and exaggeration in genre. To do the Linklater drama thing is hard. And to be honest, I saw Margaret Qualley already a couple of years ago also in these like, in a Claire Denis film, in some other bits. I thought she was great in this Claire Denis film, and everybody hates this film. It's like a hated film. So I don't know. It's like, she's very hit and miss for me, but I don't think she's a good actress.
At least in this, I was a little bit like, especially when you have to like go toe-to-toe with a heavyweight like Ethan Hawke, it was quite evident to me that, oh, maybe she's... But I did think the writing was so good, and there's this beautiful line about her when Lawrence is talking to this bartender played by Bobby Cannavale, who's also great, by the way.
Yeah.
And he just goes like, I don't know why she wants to spend time with me, because he's like an older man. Like, I don't know what she sees in me. And then he goes, maybe she just wants to be admired by one of the great admirers of beauty.
Yeah.
And it's this line that's just so beautiful. It's like, yeah, like this man, you can see in everything that he breathes and does and moves that he appreciates the arts and the beauty of life and the, as you mentioned, like the electricity of it all, that I can see why this muse that he has would want to spend time with him. She doesn't want to sleep with him or do any of that. But it's one of those like complicated relationships that I thought is just beautifully written about.
Basically, it's a classic sim story,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
We have an
she just wants to be admired.
We have an e-girl and we have an online simp, and that's it. That's Blue Moon for you. But it's a gorgeous film. It doesn't sound very sexy when you read the description. It doesn't seem like a big film, but actually it's unexpectedly one of the greats, and I can definitely recommend people to go.
Absolutely.
Last but not least, we have one more film to discuss, which is a new documentary by the North Macedonian director Tamara Kochevska. The film is called The Tale of Cillian, and it premiered at last year's Venice Film Festival. It's a documentary about the unexpected friendship between a Macedonian farmer who's gone, let's say, in economically bad times and now works at a big
garbage dump,
and his friendship with a great white stork, birds that are very prevalent in North Macedonia and now also live off the trash of these garbage piles. And he finds one wounded bird, brings it home, nourishes it, heals it, and there is this beautiful friendship between man and animal, which becomes this, let's say, reflection of the precarity of the environments that we find ourselves in. Let's listen to a clip.
I watched it this morning. I thought it was really great. I thought it was beautiful. What I love that this movie does is it's not in the first place about this man's relationship with the stork. It's about this man. He's a farmer. And like the crops are bad. They're trying to take their tobacco crop to tobacco's. And they're like, no, we can't have it. This is not good enough for the current market standards, capitalism. And so his son moves away to Germany to find work. And this all plays out over the narrator telling a story that's like an old folktale in North Macedonia, which is about Cillian, who didn't want to be a farmer. So his dad cursed him and he had to like leave the village, and the stork comes back and stands in front of his father. And
yeah, because
they
turns rebond. In the curse into a stork.
Yes. So he curses him to turn into a stork. And then it just like, I don't even know how Tamara did this. You might know more because you interviewed her.
Yeah.
But it feels to me like some parts of this are probably based on real life, but scripted, because it's almost too uncanny.
It's insane, because you're watching a documentary which is about humanity and nature and animals and men, and it has a lot of starkly realist scenes about these garbage dumps and seeing how just awful the economic state is in Macedonia right now. But then it is also a fairy tale, right? It is the tale of Cillian, and it is the retelling of the tale through these two real life characters, the bird and the man, but they have such a unique relationship that resembles this classic fairy tale. And what Tamara told me in an interview was that she grew up with this fairy tale, like many other people born in Macedonia. It's like a classic thing you tell your children, and that she always carried it with her, and that it greatly influenced also how she looked at people and about and to nature. For instance, her previous documentary, Honeyland, which was nominated for an Oscar, also is about this, like, let's say, metaphor of using the animal kingdom to kind of like say something about how humanity works right now, and then using the logic of the bee and the queen bee and the worker bee, etc.
Yeah.
And here we have basically the Urtext, right? The storks are a mirror image of humanity. And how they did it, it's insane, because they just filmed so many of these birds. They filmed these storks for like years and years in a row so that they could get used to the camera, so they could get very close, make these beautiful shots. And with these close, intimate shots of these birds, in the montage, you can make it a fairy tale with the right voiceover. It's a strange film in that sense, because you're constantly doubting, like you say.
Yeah, because like they just happened on this man who became friends with a stork while they were filming this. Like, but it doesn't even matter. Like, it's almost like watching Nathan Fielder. Like, does it even matter if it's real?
It's real or not?
It's absolutely beautiful. It's in cinemas at the end of this month. I would definitely go seek it out.
Yeah, as far as like tiny nature documentaries go, this one is also insanely touching. It's like, it also made me cry a bit. It's gorgeously shot. It has a beautiful, very friendly narration. And it's like, yeah, you're learning a lot about the world, but you're also enjoying a classic fairy tale. Yeah, it's a big recommendation.
Hamnet is screening here at Lab 111, so don't forget to get your tickets. The link is in the show notes.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab 111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.